How do we fight for truth and protect democracy in a post-truth world? How does bias affect our understanding of facts?
Lee McIntyre is a research fellow at the Center for Philosophy and History of Science at Boston University and a senior advisor for public trust in science at the Aspen Institute. He holds a BA from Wesleyan University and a PhD in philosophy from the University of Michigan. He has taught philosophy at Colgate University, Boston University, Tufts Experimental College, Simmons College, and Harvard Extension School. McIntyre is the author of nonfiction books such as On Disinformation and How to Talk to a Science Denier, as well as fictional books such as The Art of Good and Evil and The Sin Eater.
Lee McIntyre, welcome to the Creative Process and One Planet podcast.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
As an author, a novelist, popular philosopher, a philosopher of science, you really address these important questions on truth and identifying really, I think before a lot of people really were talking about a post-truth world, which we've covered in a number of your books now in different forms. Your latest book is on disinformation. And I believe before we dive into the conversation, you're going to share a passage with us to just help us understand your perspective and what you've learned over the years.
You bet. It's a very short book. Each of the chapters are quite short. And so my passage is simply to read chapter one, which is about 3 pages. So this chapter is called Truth Killers. The storming of the U.S. Capitol on January 6, 2021 was an American tragedy. It was also completely predictable. Patriots in face paint, who carried sharpened flagpoles, bats, and zip ties into the Senate chamber, were the inevitable result of 70 years of lies about tobacco, evolution, global warming, and vaccines. After the truth killers provided a blueprint for how to deny scientific facts that clashed with their financial or ideological interests, it was a small step for unscrupulous politicians to figure out how to use this strategy to lie about anything they wanted, such as the baseless claim that the 2020 presidential election was stolen and that the January 6th insurrectionists were actually peaceful protesters, or Antifa, in disguise. Welcome to the world of reality denial, where truth is subordinate to ideology, feelings have more weight than evidence, and democracy hangs in the balance. Throughout history, autocratic leaders and their wannabes have understood that the quickest way to control a population is to control their information source. But in a society that still has a free press, disinformation is the new censorship. Remember that scene in Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade where Harrison Ford has finally found the Holy Grail, but can't tell which one it is because it's surrounded by 100 fakes? That's the point of disinformation. If you can't hide or destroy the truth, surround it with bullshit. You can always kill it later. And the chapter goes on a little bit more than that, but I think that's a good start passage.
Exactly. Yeah, I love that line. Disinformation is the new censorship. You just confuse us enough. And then I think also all the noise, you've identified with your other books about, you know, flat earthers, climate deniers, science deniers. And I think with all the noise, then there's a longing for simplicity and the one big explanation, the one big lie, as you identify. So I think that there's a lot of frustration now and with AI and the way social media is, and I think the decline of journalism is that people find it hard to trust anything, or they just don't have the time to wade through all that. And that just feeds into people's vulnerabilities to following these lies, this disinformation.
It's true, because one thing that people don't realize is that the goal of disinformation is not simply to get you to believe a falsehood. It's to demoralize you into giving up on the idea of truth, which is subtle but important, because, I mean, one of the goals is to polarize us around factual issues, to get us to distrust people who don't believe the same lie that we do. But the thing is, even if somebody doesn't believe the lie, even if they know that it's a lie, it can still make them cynical. It can still make them feel like they just need to give up because it's too complicated. I mean, we've all had friends who have said, I don't even watch the news anymore. There are fact checkers, but how do you know who's fact checking the fact checkers? Who really knows what to believe? And there's a chilling quotation from Hannah Arendt, the great Holocaust historian, that I can't quote from memory. It's hanging over my desk upstairs, but I can almost remember it. She says this, so this is a paraphrase. She says, when you always lie to someone, the consequence is not necessarily that they believe the lie, but that they begin to lose their critical faculties, that they begin to give up on the idea of truth. And so they can't judge for themselves what's true and what's false anymore. And she says, with such a people, you can then go on to do anything that you like. That's the scary part. That shows the nexus between post-truth and autocracy. Because if you lie to people over and over and you can get them to say, I don't even know if there is such a thing as truth. That's what the authoritarian wants. Not necessarily to get you to believe the lie, but to give up on truth. Because when you give up on truth, then there's no blame, there's no accountability, and they can just assert their power.
In effect, you're dealing with traumatized people then. And as vulnerable as they are. And you began your other book on how to talk to a science denier with this quote from Mark Twain, it's easier to fool a person than to convince them that they've been fooled. But how do you bring them back to a sense of reality that can actually be proven?
It's hard because, as you put it, science deniers in particular, I think are victims. There's a connection between disinformation and denial. People don't just wake up one day thinking that, you know, there's a Jewish space laser or thinking that there are tracking microchips in the vaccines. I mean, where do those ideas come from? They come from somebody who made them up because it serves their own political or economic interests. And then so you've got an army of people who believe that nonsense, who are victims. So how do you bring them back? If one goal of disinformation is to breach trust, you can't just bring them back with evidence or facts because they don't trust the person sharing the facts or the evidence. So in a very real sense, once somebody's gone down that rabbit hole, you have to try to change their identity, which is almost impossible to do. Now, there are steps that you can make in that direction. You can talk to people face to face. You can treat them with respect, listen to them, be calm, don't insult them. That helps to build trust. But it is a losing battle to think that that's, you know, the only arrow in the quiver. That's all we can do is wait for somebody to believe the nonsense and then try to bring them back from it. I think a much more effective and important strategy is to keep them from hearing the disinformation in the first place, which is where my new book came from. I had just written a book called How to Talk to a Science Denier, where I was talking about, you know, talk to them in person solution, try to bring them back when they're already pretty far gone. But then I realized we don't have enough people to do that. We don't have enough time to do that. What we really need to do, in addition to talking to people, is to work on the amplification of disinformation so that people are not hearing the lies in the first place.
Exactly. What you call the pipeline, and how do we close up that pipeline? Because sometimes those exchanges can be quite charged. So I admire you for your patience and compassion when you have confronted people who really hold points of view that are difficult for me to fathom. But it's not often that we get to be face to face. A lot of this is done anonymously and online. Yeah. And even since you wrote on disinformation, you know, AI is accelerating all the time. We have with the advanced AI capabilities, there's accessibility to even the simplest ChatGPT-2 can create a lot of hate speech. It's being used for that, yeah. Content creation. So how do you foresee these bad actors leveraging this technology to propagate misinformation and extremist ideologies? And how can we inject what you've learned into this, amplify it so that you don't have to be doorstepping everyone?
The problem is that AI does make the disinformer's job easier. But I think the way that it makes it easier is that it makes the content more believable. It just creates the volume. It creates more of it. Now, that's not necessarily saying that that's going to be amplified. I mean, there have to be people who in the media, partisan or sometimes unwitting, who take that and run forward with it. But the AI challenge is a very real one because as AI gets better and better, things will go the way of deepfakes. I mean, we've all seen deepfakes and wondered, you know, is that really Tom Cruise's voice? Is that video really him? And what happens then, as I talked about earlier, the cynicism, the danger is not just that people will see the false thing and think it's true. When AI takes over with, you know, our information sources, pollutes it to a certain point, we'll stop believing that there is any such thing as truth anymore. We won't just take the false thing for true. We'll take the true thing for false. And then where are we? So now I am not one of those people who want to just get rid of AI. I think that AI can be useful for many different things. I was reading not so long ago that pancreatic cancer is by and large fatal by the time it's diagnosed because they catch it so late. And so they're feeding electronic medical records into AI and have now found certain correlations that go back decades in people who were later diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. So they're now trying to work on ways to look for patterns in health records that help people to identify who's at risk for pancreatic cancer. So, you know, I'm not just wanting to flush it all down the toilet and not deal with AI. But we do need to be aware of the threat, because what AI does is, in the wrong hands, it can be misused, just as any other technology. When ChatGPT first came out, I tried valiantly to make it create disinformation. You know, I wanted to see if I could make it say something false about vaccines. I couldn't get it to do that. And I thought, well, good, somebody's fed into the algorithm so that it won't do this. But then I immediately despaired and thought, oh no, that means it can be tampered with. And so when it falls into the hands of somebody who's a bad actor, it can be a very bad thing.
I don't mean to be alarmist, because I've had conversations with people who have been, I know that you're greatly interested in physics as well. And so I was talking with Neil Johnson, who heads up the data science program at Complexity and Data Science at George Washington University. And on this, they're predicting, because they pull back and are analyzing these hate groups and extremist groups on, like, viewing them at a great distance. So they're almost like they're particles, right? And they can analyze waves of things. And that he says that in light of recent advancements in AI capabilities, they'll maybe by summer, bad actors will be able to, like, run continuously a ChatGPT type, just generating it. They learn how to manipulate it. So exactly what you're talking about.
It's coming, and it's coming quite fast. And I think the only way to fight something like that is to raise the alarm, to let people know that it's coming so that they don't get fooled. Research has shown that pre-bunking is better than debunking. It's more effective. Let someone know there's a threat on the horizon. Here's what it looks like. Here's where you might see it. That works much better than waiting until the person has already been manipulated and then saying, oh no, don't you realize that was machine generated, or that person had an agenda, you shouldn't believe it. So, you know, people who are out there in advance warning, I think that's the appropriate response to AI.
Yes. And even, and this is what they were saying, just that's why I think that your perspectives could be really valuable, is that when in these chat groups, when you have people from polarized point of views, they just kind of were shouting at each other, and that's not productive. But if you introduce like a kindly chat bot or something, someone who's kind of on the fence, who's a voice for moderation, it really can be effective in just through the trials they've done. They haven't, you know, scaled it mm-hmm. out. But if it could be adopted by some of these large social media and AI platforms, that it can result in softening the extremes.
It can. And the challenge is scale. I mean, as disinformation gets easier and easier to create, there will be more people doing it. There will be more volume. Everyone knows about the Russian disinformation and interference in the 2016 election, but they did it again in 2020 and are doing it again in 2024, now joined by China and Iran and Venezuela and other countries that are also producing disinformation. So the barrier to the Russian troll farms used to be fluency with English. You know, you'd look at some of the disinformation and it just wasn't very good because they're cloaking the fact that it's Russian disinformation. But now, as it becomes easier to produce, it's more ubiquitous and more compelling for people.
So if you were to design or train a chatbot who is motivated for the good based on what you know, what are some of the facts you'd put in? Of course, having good facts are important. Sometimes those science deniers don't listen to the facts. Those people who believe in conspiracy, they don't believe we have these different types of facts. But what would you know if you were to train it?
If I were to train it, that's a great question. I've never been asked that because, and I mean, just viscerally, I feel that the best way to build trust is face-to-face. Human-to-human conversation is the antidote. Because what's really going on here is not just that people are hearing false facts, it's the distrust. I often say that science deniers don't have a fact deficit, they have a trust deficit. And one interesting thing that I've noticed, this doesn't really answer your question, but I guess it's orthogonal to the question, but there are some disinformation networks that are now using avatars to make them look human. So they now have newscasters in other countries that look just like you and me. They can make them look any way that they want and read whatever script that they want, because they're capitalizing on the idea that human conversation, the more human, the better. Just in the same way that they've made the voice sound more human, to now make it look like it's an actual person delivering the news. So I think the antidote to this is not to create a better AI or a better robot to fight back. I think it's to get out and talk to our neighbors and have more community interaction and have more people meet scientists and to learn to trust the people around them and to turn off some of the technology. I just don't know if there's a solution when we're getting so much disinformation from technology. Yes, we should try to cut that down. And one way to cut it down is to overwhelm it with better information. That's all to the good. But, you know, there are only so many ways. I mean, if you talk to counterterrorism officials, they'll tell you, say the truth, repeat it, and try to find messengers for the truth from the group that you're trying to influence. I think that's a simple formula that we need to follow. Can AI help with that? Maybe. Maybe it can. I'll have to think about that more. But I think the best way to implement that is human interaction.
I think that's true. I just think the only reason I'm not really a techno-optimist is just I feel like if bad actors are using it and you have to try to meet them where they are and because of the pace, it's so accelerated.
Yes. No, it's a good question. I just have a failure of imagination to think how it could be used for that purpose. I once asked ChatGPT a question along the lines of, did AI have a role in fighting disinformation? And it gave a few optimistic suggestions, but then I realized where they came from and wondered, you know, was that in some ways even worse? I used it at the end of a speech to give some hope. And then my kicker line was, but I wish I'd written that last paragraph. It was actually written by ChatGPT.
Yeah, that's the other thing. And I don't mean just to focus on AI, but this is the conversation that we're all having now, right? How disinformation and misinformation is being powered by AI. And we used to be worried just about social media. So it's interesting because a study just came out from Georgia State University showing that people are losing their ability to tell the difference between AI and human responses. Participants rated responses from AI and humans without knowing the source and overwhelmingly favored the AI's responses in terms of virtuousness, intelligence, and trustworthiness. So the twist is that now the reason people can tell the difference appears to be because they rated ChatGPT's responses as superior. Researchers said that if they had done the study 5 or 10 years ago, then we might have predicted that people could identify the AI because of how inferior its responses were, but that they found the opposite this time in that the AI, in a sense, performed too well.
Oh, interesting. It's too good.
Yeah. I think they'll find a way to average it out, right?
Yeah. And this will infiltrate all facets of human life. I was reading a law review article the other day where a lawyer was bemoaning the day when video and audio evidence could no longer be used in court because jurors would be so savvy to the problem of deepfakes that anything that you heard that was real, they would say, oh, that's just a fake. And I mean, think back to the Access Hollywood tape from Trump in 2016. I mean, he said at the time, oh, that's fake. But there was no take to that because the fakes weren't that good. And it was him. And then you saw the video. And I mean, how could somebody fake like that? I'm not so sure now. If something like that came out now, I think that he might double and triple down on the idea that I never said that. That wasn't me. That was fake. The day is coming quite soon when we will lose all confidence in audio and video evidence. For the law enforcement, it's a chilling thing. And again, what's the solution? Human interaction, human eyewitnesses, which are also, you know, unreliable in a way. But I look for hope. And the hope that I see is that people tend to trust other human beings once they get to know them.
Yes. And that's why we really have to support, I think, legacy media, journalism. It's difficult, as you know. I don't yet say we're in a post-truth world. We're on that route. But maybe you think we're already in a post-truth world. But how can we ensure the long-term viability of the fourth estate? Yes.
I mean, someone said recently, it wasn't me. I wish this was something that I could take credit for. We now live in an era in which the truth is behind a paywall and the lies are free. One way to support legacy media is to buy the damn subscription. I mean, when you see something free, maybe it should make us a little skeptical. When we see something behind a paywall and we think, oh, I'll just find another source. No, maybe we should pay the subscription fee. And I mean, another way to support media, I think think, is to criticize them when they're doing a bad job, but to support them when they're doing a good job. Good investigative media is expensive, but this kind of both sides journalism, where, you know, they'll book a liar just so that it doesn't look like they're biased, because they'll have a liar in the program to tell the other side. But again, another quotation that I wish I could take credit for, this one's Stuart Stevens. How do you tell both sides of a lie? You can't. I mean, so really respect for good old-fashioned investigative journalism, just the hard-nosed person, what Meet the Press used to be with Tim Russert, where he said that his guiding philosophy was to study everything that he possibly could and then take the other side, you know, in interviewing the person. That's how to do it. But, you know, you don't see that done as much anymore. There are great examples of it. Christiane Amanpour is a brilliant example of this. Nicole Wallace, another great example of this. So, I mean, you do find people who are not afraid to go there. My latest beef against the media is that up until recently, they wouldn't even use the word disinformation. They would say misinformation, which is toothless, because misinformation just means a mistake. But disinformation is a lie, which means there has to be a liar, which means you have to expose the plot. Who's the liar? Why are they lying? Who's the money behind the lie? But I think the stakes are high enough that we have to do that. I've been cheered recently that you do now see many legacy media outlets using the word disinformation, and that's, I think, key.
Yes, of course, they're afraid of lawsuits, and it is kind of unfair. I wonder how you stand on this, because, you know, social media, whether they're just pathways for spreading disinformation and misinformation, because they're both flow on those roads, yes. But whether they should be, you know, more responsible in the way that media is.
There's a way. I mean, George Lakoff, this psychologist who said, when you're going to tell a lie, when you're going to report on a lie or piece of misinformation, do it in a truth sandwich. Say what the truth is, say what the lie is and what the person's interest is in saying it. And then on the other bun, say, but that's false. And, you know, remind people what the truth is. So I mean, that's one way to do it. Another is just to remember that we all have cognitive biases. And when we hear someone speak uncorrected, you know, with no interruption, that has a devastating effect. So what CNN used to do, where they would play Trump rallies unedited in full, you know, with no editorial interruption or correction at all, that was horribly damaging. I mean, that's just not the way. When someone is lying, they need to be challenged. They need to be corrected. Jonathan Swan does a great job in interviews. I saw Caitlin Collins do a terrific interview the other day. I mean, there are people who are doing this very well, but it's hard to do. It's hard to do good journalism. I mean, it shouldn't be that hard if you have the right values. But I mean, sometimes I think that the lazy way to do it is just to say, just let both sides talk. Let both sides talk. But see, that suggests that truth is somewhere in the middle. If it's a lie, no, truth is not somewhere in the middle. And they've done a bad job of disinforming their audience or amplifying the lie. There was an empirical study which showed that people who watched Fox News were less well-informed than if they hadn't consumed any media at all. That's a tragedy.
Yeah, that, and some of them are really watching it chronically.
Chronically, yes.
Sometimes I feel like we don't just have barriers within the basis of our facts and within truth, but also in the terms that are being used, particularly in academia. Do you think that the complex vocabulary of academia is leading to the spread of more disinformation?
Complex. I don't think it's necessarily leading to more disinformation, but it allows disinformers to hide, because disinformers are opportunists. They will exploit divisions where they exist. So if there's jargon, if there's lack of precision and meaning, they will exploit that. You know, if somebody is out there in academe making an outrageous claim, there's no such thing as objective truth. All assertions of truth are merely an assertion of the political beliefs of the individual saying. They'll exploit that because that's what they want.
Right. We have to have a vocabulary that we all have access to. And that's what you do so well in your books. So with so much of your work focused on identifying disinformation, bad actors, and trust in a post-truth era, I'm wondering, how do you avoid burnout and cynicism and maintain your belief in the resilience of democracy and institutions?
I am the way I was raised. I'll say that. My dad fought in World War II in France. And my mom was an electrician on building warships. dealerships in the United States. You know, you hear Rosie the Riveter, but you don't hear of Drina the electrician. But my mom was an electrician on building warships. So, I mean, they were both war workers and they were both very proud to be Americans and instilled in me from an early age that the wonderful thing about America is that anybody could be an American. You didn't have to be born here, that you didn't have to be a particular ethnicity or speak a certain language or be a certain religion. That the wonderful thing about America was that you just had to believe in an idea, and that meant it was open for everyone. And I find great hope in that, because despite all the horrible rhetoric you hear now about people seeking asylum and immigrants, I'm cheered by just the casual conversations I have with people, with strangers who have just come to this country. And it makes me understand that what we have in the United States is actually very messy and very difficult to do. And not many countries try to do it. And so despite all of our flaws in the U.S., I really believe in the idea of from many one, you know, that we have great diversity in the United States, but we're trying to do a very difficult thing, which is all to pull in the same direction. And so that sustains me, because I think that deep down, most Americans actually believe that. Some of their minds have been poisoned into thinking that immigrants are a threat or into hate. And I just think that's wrong. And so in my work, I'm trying to fight that by fighting for the idea of truth. The subtitle of my book is How to Fight for Truth and Protect Democracy, because I think they're related. I think that the authoritarians who want to tear down democratic systems do so by fighting against truth. And as a philosopher, I mean, what do philosophers believe in more strongly than the concept of truth? I can't really think of anything. So I don't ever get burned out on that, but I do occasionally take a break from writing about post-truth and disinformation and science denial. And I do other things that I'm not always just writing about these bromidic topics.
Yes, I want to say more recently, you've begun to write novels, and also mm-hmm. you have this long practice, or you had for 13 years, martial arts. And yes. I wonder how maybe that's a way of cutting through the BS and what that has trained your mind.
The novel writing was simply that I wanted to learn. I wanted the challenge of trying something new. And writing novels is incredibly hard. I mean, so difficult. And I love to read. I mean, my outlet when I go on vacation is I'll read thriller fiction. I'll practically read anything by John Grisham. And I love to read thrillers, and thought, well, how hard could this be? Well, as it turns out, extremely difficult. And the other fun thing about writing thrillers is it's all a lie. I mean, fiction is a lie, isn't it? Except that there's some truths that you can only tell through fiction, I think. But you get to make up a story, and there's a lot of blood and guts and sex and violence in thrillers. And so in a way, that's an outlet. Another outlet was all the martial arts that I did for all those years. Now, to some people, that doesn't sound like an outlet, because I took Shotokan karate, which is a very disciplined form of Japanese karate. And I mean, it's an outlet, but sensei will walk across the dojo and say toes, because your toe is off by a quarter of an inch. I mean, it's very disciplined. But I found a great outlet just in the physical release of energy, being able to do martial arts. And then unfortunately, after all those years of loving it and my kids doing it with me, and they surpassed me many years ago, they're both instructor level in their knowledge in martial arts. Very proud of them. They studied more than one. I just studied karate. They've done many different martial arts. I hurt myself and so couldn't continue with the martial arts, and struggled to find something that was exercise but was fun. And one day on the way to karate, knowing that I was going to be in mortal pain by the time I ended just through repetitive stress, I saw through this plate glass window all these young women exercising with huge smiles on their faces. And I thought, I haven't had fun exercising in a long time. It was a bar, which for people who don't know is like dancing. It's like ballet without the dancing. It's all the small muscle movements and stress positions. And so I thought, well, they're having fun. I may be the only man in the class and I'm 3 times older, but we'll see. And I talked to the owner and she said, sure, you know, come on in. What a humbling experience, because I thought I was strong. I was not strong. All these little tiny muscles, I mean, they're strong. And then there's dancers strong. Dancers are incredibly strong. And so it was a great workout. And for the first time in my life, I I really did get in very good shape doing bar because I learned a different kind of discipline. And it was just joyful the whole time. People were laughing, they were talking, they played music. It was just, and I made friends that I never would have made otherwise. And so that was a very joyful thing too.
Yes. I've done bar, I do dance every day. So I share that. And it also occurred to me, you know, in your practice of karate, that these are skills that you could come to bear when you're across from somebody who doesn't share your beliefs, but you have to engage with them on like an intimate level. You have to really understand what it's like to be behind their eyes and utilize their energy.
You do. I mean, martial arts is engaging. I mean, it's combat engaging, but it is engaging. And there are a couple of things, I guess, inform my philosophical work. The first is don't fear the blow. It's coming. I mean, don't shrink away from it. But the other is that you have to be in control of your own energy. It sounds like a cliche, but it's really true. And anybody who's done martial arts will recognize it, that the real enemy you're fighting is yourself, is the fear that you have in a combat situation. And that, you know, would you rather have an opponent who doesn't show any fear? No, that's the worst opponent you can have, the one who knows exactly what they're doing. So that's the opponent that you want to be. But once you've got that confidence, once you don't fear the blow and you've got that confidence, many times you don't have to fight. You can redirect the energy. And I've watched my kids do this in jujitsu and other martial arts that they've done. It's much more so than Shotokan karate, which is a very hard meet force with force. There are many martial arts where they redirect the energy, you know, take the opponent's energy and redirect it. So I learned a lot about human interaction from martial arts. And when I walked into a ballroom of 650 flat earthers, and I was maybe the only person who didn't agree with them, I wasn't afraid. There was nothing to be afraid of. They were just other human beings who didn't agree with me. And if I treated them with respect and calm, we were going to have good conversations. There's at the beginning of every Shotokan lesson, there's a dojo-kun, the dojo philosophy, which I found very meaningful. And, you know, one part of it was refrain from violent behavior. But another part was respect others. That's a very important part of martial arts. And that informed the way that I interact with people who I disagree with.
I think it's also excellent training. So much of what we say, or particularly people who have been programmed or brainwashed in a certain way that at least it doesn't line up with our way of thinking, it's not so much about thinking or logic. It's about the words that they say aren't necessarily what brought them to that opinion, in my yes. opinion. It's another level of communication. It's about tone. It's about, you know, feeling. And that's why they might be easily led along by a charismatic individual, even if they don't necessarily believe it, but they like the energy. So being able to read that, where they're coming from, I think serves you well in those conversations.
I think that's right. And I mean, people, the magic thing about face-to-face conversation, people don't want to hate you. They want to be heard. And if you listen to them, they'll listen to you. It's a magic of conversation. I enjoy it. And people can smell it on you if you don't trust them, if you're angry, if there's condescension. But if you can encounter people with a kind of a curiosity where sometimes people have yelled at me, insulted me to my face, and I don't react. I don't get angry and I don't react. Just, you know, right back at them, but approach them with curiosity. Why would you react like that? Or just to let them get it out of their system and listen to what they have to say. Eventually, you can dissipate that negative energy. It doesn't always work. I mean, during the pandemic, I didn't let people with no mask breathe on me because, you know, they were anti-maskers. No, and I do know how to defend myself, but you don't need to use it as often as you think.
This is Devin Mullins from American University. I'm taking a moment just to reflect on what I have really been thinking about as I participated in this interview and the editing process. In particular, I've been thinking about the way that in the creation of content, how disinformation and misinformation are spread and perpetuated. In particular, I'm thinking about the difference between live media and edited and carefully prepared media. For instance, in our 24-hour news cycle that we have today, so much news is just aired live, and whatever a reporter says is immediately what goes on air a few seconds later. There's a lot of room for disinformation to be spread that way, for things to be said and not be fact-checked. And there is no fact-checking of the fact-checkers to be had because they are already on to the next thing. And this contrasts very heavily to something like this podcast, for instance. I've really been thinking about my own role in how information is spread. I edit podcasts with the Creative Process and One Planet podcast, and I edit for clarity. I edit for making sure that what is being said is understandable, that the flow of sentences sounds correct, that unnecessary ums and uhs and connecting words are cut. And in that, I present something that is not entirely what happened within an interview, which I think is very interesting. One could say that you are missing something fundamentally human when I take out longer gaps without speech, when I take out an author or a thinker and their actual thinking time, and I am presenting something that is technically false to the public, but it is false for clarity. So what is that line there? I also think you then come to the problem of certain podcasts and long-form video that is edited, that is responsible for disinformation, and you can feel the intentionality behind that disinformation because you know that it was carefully edited. There is someone behind the scenes who is choosing what should stay and what should not stay. It isn't just being said into the ether like live news content, but instead carefully selected for an audience, which I think really points back to what Lee is saying with the intentionality behind disinformation and that there is always someone who it is benefiting. And I think that that is something that we should all keep in mind as we listen and engage with things online. Now, back to the episode. To add on to this conversation about academia and how we learn and what we learn and what information people have access to, I had some really interesting experiences with education growing up in the South. Notably, at one point after I went to college, my sister came home and told my family about her new 11th grade world history teacher, who had made the whole class take an ungraded preparatory pop quiz on the first day that asked questions like, what did Adam and Eve look like? And who was, quote, that scientist guy who said that humans came from monkeys? In addition to those questions, the teacher identified AD as standing for after death and BCE as standing for before the Christian era, rather than kind of the Latin and before the common era terms that are much more widely used today. For many students in my high school, this world history class is the last history class that they will ever take. So what does it mean for our culture that education systems are not currently based on the same facts and the same idea of truth across the country? So how do we work towards amending that divide?
I'm not sure there's a one-size-fits-all answer because American education right now is fairly fractured. And I'm not simply talking about the difference between public school and private school, or the fact that there's parochial school or homeschooling, where you can get big doses of ideology along with your facts. I guess what I'm interested in here is the fact that even in science education these days, there seems to be a lot of political pressure over what you can and cannot say. In history class in Florida, over what you can and cannot say. I think people are educated best when they're allowed to ask all the hard questions. When certain questions are off limits, I think that's when someone is in danger of being miseducated. Or I'll tell you what, even if you're trying to convince them that something is true, if something's off limits, that's exactly where they're going to go. I have great respect for, I'm not a religious person, but I have great respect for the religions that allow you to ask whatever question you want to say, you know, how is it that these two things can be true at the same time? And then have a conversation about it, because that's actually how you persuade people. When certain things are taboo or we wish they weren't true so we don't teach them, we're doing a great disservice. So I'm all in favor of, you know, the most progressive education that people can have. And I say this because I've taught not only college, but a couple of classes, at least. I taught fifth graders. I taught fifth graders logic. And I mean, I've been a dad and, you know, raised kids and trained both my kids to be philosophers. And I know just how curious kids are. You've got to let them spread their wings and ask all those questions, or they simply don't learn. How we get past that? Boy, I think that's a political question. I think we need different people in office.
Yes, and perhaps also give greater support to teachers.
Absolutely. How many people vote in their school board elections? How many people take that seriously? And I'll tell you something that I learned at Flat Earth. They're coming for your school board. Do you think the evolution deniers came for your school board a long time ago and got slapped back by the courts in various ways? But they're still out there, the people who want to control what you can teach in a classroom or not. Flat Earthers, part of their agenda, part of their long-term plan is to run for school board, teach the controversy. Oh. It sounds insane. It sounds laughable, but it is not. Those elections, not just, you know, who runs for president or senator, who runs for school board can make an enormous difference in your life.
Right. I hadn't realized that. So I have not really been exposed to that level of belief.
It's out there. And in school, that's the problem, right? I think of all the pushback decades ago on trying to get evolution not to be taught in public schools. But then the new goal, which was, well, if you're going to teach evolution in public schools, you also need to teach intelligent design. Despite the fact that there was no scientific evidence for this, but there were textbooks, and why don't you teach from this textbook? And I mean, as I said, there's a whole history on this. Michael Ruse, another philosopher, did a collection called But Is It Science?, which is an anthology, very interesting on this topic. But I mean, there are always skirmishes about what people allow to be taught in schools. And it's usually because it steps on somebody's toes, of their identity or their ideology, their religion, their political beliefs. People don't want their kids being taught things that clash with their own identity or ideological beliefs.
With what both you and Mia have brought up here, there is such a divide in how people see the world within Christianity, within science, within politics, within so many different facets of life. And I think we often perceive that as a divide specifically between rural and urban people. So how do we help folks at each end of that spectrum understand and accept the perspective of the other more readily? What does that do for disinformation and for truth?
I wish there were a way for people to have more interaction than they do. I mean, when people travel more widely and they visit areas where they have a certain stereotype about who they're going to meet, those tend to get blown away when they actually go there, when they meet them. I've had the privilege of being able to travel cross country 6 times. And you meet people and you don't meet the people who you expect, and they say weird things, and you find out that you have more in common with them than you think. And I've given talks in deep red states, and not just in the blue bubbles that exist in the deep red states, but sometimes to audiences where they did not like what I had to say. And it is enlightening. There's another piece of martial arts that comes along in here. This one from Bruce Lee: never underestimate your opponent. I mean, if you think that all anti-vaxxers are just idiots, you don't understand how much they've read. You don't understand where it comes from. You don't understand the studies that they've read, the data that they're referring to. Now, sometimes it's disinformation. Sometimes they have no idea what they're talking about. But sometimes deniers are quite intelligent people who have read, I mean, some of the flat earthers had read more physics than I had. They just weren't applying it in the right way. Why? Because they didn't trust the scientists. So you don't want to underestimate or make assumptions about who someone is before you enter in that conversation with them. And another thing to realize, I think, is that people are radicalized around issues sometimes when they're afraid. I mean, when you're scared, who wants to harm their child? Who wants to think that they're doing something wrong that's going to harm their child? That a lot of anti-vax comes from that. I think we need to have that front and center when we're trying to convince someone that, you know, well, there aren't any microchips in the vaccines. I mean, one way to do that is to expose it as the Russian disinformation campaign that it was, and it is, and it's in my book if anybody wants to read about that. Was a Russian disinformation campaign which people fell for. But another way is simply to say, you know, if their beliefs are met with contempt, then they just shut down and they go elsewhere. But, you know, if you're a physician, say, and you've got someone who doesn't want to take a vaccine, the appropriate response, I don't think, is, oh, I'm surprised that you're an intelligent person. Why would you think that? It's to say, what are you afraid will happen? What have you heard? And where did you hear it? And to engage that person in dialogue, I think that's much more persuasive. Urban, rural, I don't know. I mean, I've lived in rural areas, mostly in cities, you know, throughout my life, but I have lived in rural areas, and people enjoy talking. They even enjoy talking to people that they don't agree with, as long as you're cordial.
Yeah, exactly. And some of that, when you're talking about families and things that are being passed on, the practical wisdom, that might, some of it be, you know, folk wisdom, some of it might be, you know, misinformation. It's often, you know, to your families and your networks. And so that's...
Yes, that's right.
You mentioned there about, it reminded me of your book, and I'm sorry that we had moved on from that, but the What Would You Do for Your Child? And it reminded me of the plot then of The Sin Eater, and also your novel, The Art of Good and Evil. You know, you're exploring, it's interesting because you say it's a kind of not escape, but it seems like an interesting space to explore the moral complexities that face, yes, in those books, the characters Jonathan Poe and Adam Grammaticus. Yes. They're both characters are forced to confront the blurred lines between right and wrong. And why did you choose to tell those stories in novel form?
I love that. Thank you for asking me that. I taught ethics for 10 years. I don't do any research in ethics. I'm a philosopher. I learned ethics. I know ethics, but I never did scholarship in ethics. That's sort of why I wanted to teach it, because I thought I don't have strong feelings about whether Kant was right versus Mill. I don't have commitments that this, you know, particular theory of ethics has to be right. So I was open-minded, and I thought that made me a better teacher in ethics. And one thing that I learned in teaching ethics, and it was just fun. I mean, I loved being a teacher. I don't really do it anymore, but I loved being a teacher. One thing that I learned is that so much of ethics is geared around, I mean, theoretical ethics, normative ethics, is geared around justification and theory. You know, telling people, this is why you should do the right thing. But that doesn't hold a candle to people's intuition. People actually know what's right, and then they invent the theory later to justify what they already believe to be true. And so I wrote The Art of Good and Evil was actually my first novel. It was published second, but it was my first novel. And I wrote that because one day I was teaching, and I was standing at the edge of the podium in a building. I taught at Harvard Extension School, the evening class, the one where the janitors and the service workers take classes. And, you know, I'm blue collar to the bone, the way I grew up. And I mean, this was the most important teaching I've ever done. I loved it. I kept thinking, why am I trying to convince them how important ethics is as a theoretical subject when everybody already knows in their bones how important ethics is from an intuitive point of view? And what would happen if you tried to live your life just according to what Mill said was true, the greatest good for the greatest number? It would be a disaster. And that's when I got the idea for The Art of Good and Evil, which is a kind of a reductio ad absurdum of utilitarian ethics. Now, if you call a book utilitarian vigilante, nobody will buy it. But if you call it The Art of Good and Evil, then maybe a few more people will buy it. But the book is a textbook in ethics underneath, you know, the bottom of the glacier. On its surface, it's a hair on fire thriller about murder and sex and violence and all this other stuff to keep you turning the pages. And the reason I told it in novel form is because sometimes what really compels people is a story, not an argument. And so I had something finally that I wanted to say about ethics, which is that moral theory is not going to convince anybody to do anything that they don't already think is right. But I couldn't say that except in fiction. And the other thing that I learned in teaching ethics was that sometimes the barrier is that people don't care. It's not that they don't believe, it's that they don't care. But what do I care about more than anything? It's the people I love. That's how you get to people. And the thing that could make me cross every moral boundary I ever thought I had is if my children were in danger. And so The Art of Good and Evil is about basically a man who's lost everything, tries to live according to the dictates of moral theory, and encounters horrible consequences. The Sin Eater is a little more fast-paced on because it was my second book that was published first, still moral grounds. How far would you go to save your child who is in peril? Would you break the law? Would you do immoral things? Yes, you would. And so I love to read Joe Finder. I love to read Grisham. I love to read people who write about an ordinary guy in extraordinary circumstances, kind of the dad who has to become badass to save his family. That's my favorite, Harlan Coben. I love that kind of book. And so I wanted to write that kind of book. And it took me 10 years to learn. And I mean, I tore down and rewrote Art of Good and Evil so many times that I basically had to put it aside and start again on a new novel just to start again. And then that one got published. And then I published the first one second. But I'm not sure I have a third novel in me. But boy, was it fun to learn how to write fiction. I just had a ball with it.
Yes, well, it comes across, and perhaps you're a hard critic of your own work, so you weren't ready to put it out there quickly, because you're really boiling down a lifetime of knowledge, but then translating it into a fiction that we can all enjoy as a thriller. So yes, it does come across. I was got to explore it. You talk about, getting people to care about ethics. Of course, it affects us. But, sometimes teachers are the ones that, help. It's not just the information. All your work is about, it's not just information or disinformation. It's about how we apply it to our lives and how we bring that forth. I'm wondering about, teachers or mentors or collaborators who've been important to you, what they shared with you, and your broader reflections on the future of education, the future of work. All this is changing with AI. And how do you see the future of education evolving to prepare students for the uncertainties?
Getting people to care is the most important thing. I went all the way to the Maldives for research for my book, How to Talk to a Science Denier, because I wanted to see coral death. I wanted to see the Maldives. I wanted to see the country the most under threat from climate change. One of my teachers was a 17, 18-year-old kid who was a captain of a fishing boat who said, "Oh, sir, outside the Maldives, no one cares." And that was when I realized that climate denial was not just about belief, it was about caring. He was right. Could you get people to care? How do you get people to care about what happens to the Maldives? They have to go there and meet people know someone in order to care. I've been really fortunate in my life to have a lot of teachers in that way, sometimes short interactions. Formally, I had an absolutely wonderful high school history teacher, Dave Corcoran. I dedicated on disinformation to him, who taught me to think for myself and not to be afraid to express what I thought. It was really terrific. He taught me not only U.S. history, but also Black history and environmental studies. And he was a very important person in my life. In college, Richard Adelstein, an economist, who was really my mentor in thinking that I could become a philosopher. Now, he was an economist, but a very philosophical economist who basically said, do not go to graduate school in economics. They won't let you do what you're interested in. You've got to go to philosophy graduate school. And was so far apart from me in our views about economics, the sciences, that it was incredible. Because I wanted to make social science more scientific, and he thought there's no way it should try to be scientific. And so we argued for years and years. He ended up inviting me, because I lived all the way in the West Coast and I went to school on the East Coast. He invited me to Thanksgiving dinner every year, including after I graduated, when I brought my wife and children. So for 20 some years, I sat at his Thanksgiving table. So, the people who have really taught me are the people who I've loved and have loved me and, cared to nurture that. But I've got to start with my mom, because my mom did not go to college. She, in her era, her baby brother went to college. She didn't go to college. But my mom was extraordinarily intelligent. And she was interested in all sorts of things that for a suburban housewife with agoraphobia for 10 years, you wouldn't think would be in her bailiwick. But she was fascinated with Einstein. She wanted to understand physics. And so when I was just a little boy, so I grew up in Portland, Oregon, where it's mostly cloudy all the time. But some nights you could see all the stars. And when it was a cold night and you could see all the stars, she would wrap me up in a blanket, run outside, and we would look at the stars. And she said things like this, we would just look at the stars. And I said, "What are the stars?" I was 4 years old. I said, "What are the stars?" And she said, "They're suns. They're just very far away." And I said, "So our sun is a star?" She said, "Yes, it's just very close to us. We're really fortunate." And my next question was, So all those stars in the sky, do they have planets like the Earth, like Jupiter, like Pluto? And she looked up and said, I still remember this to this day. She said, "Probably. We just haven't found them yet." And this was 1967. So, they hadn't found any yet. And when I gave her eulogy a few years ago, she died at 96. They had found 4,000 exoplanets. So she was right. Giordano Bruno was burned at the stake in 1600 in the Campo di Fiori in Rome for what my mom was saying in 1967, that yes, there are other worlds out there. We just haven't found them yet. That was so inspiring to me. My mom really was the one who made me become a philosopher.
Well, that's wonderful how she imparted that sense of curiosity and wonder. And I think that opens up what your reflections are about the beauty and wonder of the natural world and the kind of world for the next generation.
Yes, because that kind of teaching that she did and that I try to channel in raising my own kids, my wife and I both, that take children seriously And the answer should never be because I said so. It should be, well, what do you think? Well, let's have a conversation. We never talk baby talk to our kids because my mom never talked baby talk to me. She treated me seriously as if my opinions mattered. And I think that makes a difference for the world that we leave, because then kids are able to stand on their own two feet and to actually educate themselves and defend themselves, because education, formal education, ends, but, you know, we continue to learn. So, you know, there was a way in which, you know, my mom taking me seriously as a thinker from the age at which I could talk allowed me the confidence to go forward and to take myself seriously enough, even though I was a, you know, we grew up in a blue collar family near the airport. We didn't have any money. My dad was an electrician. He became disabled. We were poor. We lived in an impoverished neighborhood, and I went to terrible public schools for the first part of my life. But I always had it better than the other kids because I had parents who believed in education and a mom who just talked to me, because my dad was at work, but talked to me constantly about, well, what do you think the answer is? And I'd just to engage with me. I miss her.
Well, you have conversations with her in your writing, I'm sure, every day as you continue her pursuit, her curiosity and her pursuit of knowledge. So thank you, Lee McIntyre, for all you do to make us care, your commitment to fighting for truth and protecting democracy, just helping us understand how to come to terms with the roots of disinformation and more effectively communicate science and embrace those who hold opposing views with compassion and understanding so that we can minimize polarization and reach a common ground. We all live on one planet we call home. Thank you for adding your voice to One Planet Podcast and the creative process.
Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed this conversation.
One Planet Podcast is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation. This interview was conducted by Mia Funk and Devin Mullins with the participation of collaborating universities and students. Associate interview producers on this episode were Sophie Bernier and Devin Mullins. One Planet Podcast is produced by Mia Funk. Associate text editor was Nadia Lamb. Additional production support by Katie Foster. Theme music is written and performed by Juan Sanchez. We hope you've enjoyed this program. If you'd like to get involved in One Planet Podcast and be part of the climate change solution, just drop us a line at team@oneplanetpodcast.org. Thank you for listening.